Our guest on this hour of the Made of Clay Report is Pamela Goddard. Good morning, Pamela. It's good to have you with us.
Hi.
So the way we start is with this question, is with a big question, which is, who are you? What are some of the details, some of the facts or the qualities that it will help us to get to start the conversation, to get to know you?
Well, who am I? I suppose for everyone, a kind of complicated question.
Yeah, absolutely.
I wear lots of different hats, so who I am sort of depends on who I'm talking to.
So now you're talking to the general public.
Or at least
WRFI's listening audience, which may not qualify as the general public.
So a lot of local people at this point, well, they might know me a couple of different ways. I'm a contra dance caller. I'm a singer. I'm currently the town clerk in the town of Danby, which doesn't feel like who I am, but it's the role I play.
Right, and some of the things we are roles, so, things we do.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, there's that public persona of being in the town. There's who I am. When I thought about this question, you know, because you did send questions ahead, and that was helpful, I thought to myself, who I am? I'm a mix of all the people I've known, and I'm a listener. And I think in some ways, you know, for all the things that I do, being a listener is really key, because I need to listen to people in town. I need to listen to what's happening when I'm taking minutes in the meetings. Before this job, I did some freelance writing and a lot of interviews, so I was a listener that way. And before that, I was working as a local historian, so I was listening to the stories of the past. So I had all those little pieces. What that makes me, I'm not sure. It's sort of a combination of things. Over time, but yeah.
And also in your role as a contra dance caller, you're also listening to the music, and you're watching, and you're taking in what the dancers are doing, and being the mediator between the two.
And listening to what's sort of needed at the moment, what's the energy level, what's the skill level, you know, do we want to go up in energy, do we want to take it down a little bit with some smooth jigs, you know, or some smoother kind of dance. So, yeah, there's that. And the same with when I'm singing for people. Kind of listening to what is happening inside me, listening to what's happening outside, and how those things meet.
Right. Yeah, and it's kind of like the practice of presence.
Yeah.
To put a slightly spiritual spin on it.
Yeah.
So you brought music with you, and we're going to start with a piece. What do you want to say anything about
it beforehand? Well, I say contra dance caller. In some ways, I could say country dance caller, because I also call English country dances, and that music is some of my favorite. And I think what we're going to listen to is a piece called Barberini's Tambourini by a group called Bare Necessities, fabulous English country dance band.
And we're going to listen to that now.
All right. Thank you.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Pamela Goddard. Pamela, what I'd like to go to next is what experience or experiences have really contributed to shaping the life you live now and what you value now, what you do now?
Well, there's many, of course.
Sure.
Some of the experiences are the people I know, and as I was listening to that, I was thinking of a wonderful teacher and mentor that I had, Christine Helwig. She lived in Larchmont, New York, in Westchester County, and taught me a lot about English country dancing, taught me a lot about working with people. She was also very involved and committed to environmental protection and land protection. She helped establish a major preserve in Larchmont. And she was involved in her community. She was the town supervisor in Larchmont in, I think, the 60s or 70s. So in some ways, she was a little bit of an inspiration when I realized, oh, I'm getting into town politics. This isn't completely dissociated from who I am as a dance caller and musician and someone who is also very committed to land preservation and environmental protection. So finding people like that who really have a broad depth to their person helps, or has made me helped confirm who I am, I would say. Then you know, there's sort of the ongoing life stories, challenges, and some of that has led me to a path. And it's hard to remember which specific events happened along the chain that pulled me in that way, except that I remember as a young teenager hearing some meditation teachers. Actually, I had the incredible fortune to hear Alan Watts speak when I was, I think, 13 or 14. He was giving a lecture at St. John the Divine in New York City, and I grew up just north of New York City, so I went down with my parish priest and my family, and we heard him speak, and it was an incredibly transitional moment, I would say, to hear him.
What did you take away from that?
What I took away from that was sort of my first steps into present moment only moment and being connected to the minutiae of the world around me. He was very funny. And I don't remember a lot of specifics, but just sort of a general sense of breathe, feel yourself in your body, be present, and be aware of what's going into you, what's coming out of you. From there, heard other teachers along the way, and I've been very, very, very fortunate to have a lot of good present moment, wonderful moment kinds of teachers.
When you're 13 and you hear that that message, how did it affect your posture, your body, your
I think it did. Well, it certainly, you know, kind of altered my perception in ways that were good for my health in some ways, because I realized from that moment and some other moments, I don't need to use external substances to alter my mind.
Right.
I can do it very easily just from my internal. So I never did much in the way of drugs, which was a good thing, because a lot of people around me really were. I saw some people go downhill very, very badly. I've been thinking about them as the current opiate addiction crisis is coming up, but don't really know what to do with that. So I wouldn't say that's, you know, something that's a driving force, but
it's an awareness.
It's an awareness.
I served a congregation on City Island in the Bronx in the mid '80s when I was in seminary, and there were lots of people on methadone maintenance and other who had been part of the heroin addiction community that was very, very large on City Island, which was kind of halfway between Manhattan and Larchmont.
So there were those moments that helped steer me, I would say, in a healthy direction. Mm-hmm. I may have been, I was a spacey kid. I had the nickname Mystic when I was that age. So I was kind of floating out there in my own self-induced alternate reality.
Reverie with the world.
And kind of, you know, grooving on nature and grooving on music and interesting people that I'd meet along the way. Thinking about those times, I was fortunate that I grew up in a family where I had a parents that would take me to something like hearing Alan Watts speak.
I also, did you grow up in an Episcopal
church? I grew up in an Episcopal church. It was an interesting church, actually, because it kind of shifted from very, folk mass kind of thing in the late 60s, early 70s. And then we got a new priest who really liked singing the mass. So he went a little bit more high church. He brought in some incense sometimes. And I kind of liked that. So there was that, but at the same time there was kind of this earth awareness sort of meditation, but not really having any training background to that. And then we also did a lot of folk music kinds of things. The first concert I got taken to was a Richie Havens concert. We did a lot of the Clearwater family picnics before there was the Clearwater Festival up and down the Hudson River.
Right.
So I got exposed to a lot of really good music that way and really interesting people from Elizabeth Cotton to Jimmy Sands to Irish musicians, and of course Pete Seeger all the time. So that in some ways felt like the basis of who I am, hearing that environmental message, hearing that musical message, hearing the community message of getting together, sharing food, sharing music, and cleaning up the river.
How did those experiences morph through your 20s and 30s and 40s?
I became so many different people through those times really...
And maybe an easier way to take the question would be, how have the issues that you've cared about changed over the years? And sometimes when you look back at issues that you've cared about, then you can see how you shifted so that those things changed.
In some ways, they haven't.
I would expect that to be,
and in some ways, surprising ways. In some ways, sad ways. It seems like some of the battles, if you will, that we were fighting for equality, justice, for
cleaning up the Hudson.
I mean, the Hudson's way cleaner.
Right.
We actually swam in the Hudson when I was a kid, and you'd come out with gray-green slime on you. It was kind of nasty.
Yeah.
So I don't think that happens anymore. People can actually swim and not have to worry too much about getting the water in your mouth. I don't know. I haven't swum in the Hudson in a long time. But those issues are still strong. You know, we still need to be raising our voices and living in a way that protects things. I think part of what might have shifted is, rather than looking at a action, I look at personal responsibility. And something shifted in me probably in my 20s when I realized I can't change anybody else. The only person I can change is myself.
What led, do you remember what led to that realization?
You know, I don't, I just remember that happening. It was actually while I was waitressing. I took a year off between high school and college because I didn't know exactly what I wanted to do. And I waitressed at a Howard Johnson's, which was, you see, just everybody, you know, it was right. It was the Howard Johnson's right next to the Tappan Zee Bridge. So it was people that were getting off a highway. It was local people. So it was a real cross section of humanity coming through there. And maybe it was that, just being exposed to lots of different people. But I just remember at one point while I was carrying glasses of water from one table to another, thinking, you know, the only person I really have any control over is myself. And it may have just been one of those things where all the right things came together at the right moment. And that's been kind of a thread that's carried through. And if anything, that's just gotten stronger through different interactions that I've had, different teachers that have had reinforced that in me and given me ways to transform some of the difficult things in my life. So.
And that also makes you engage issues, larger social issues, systemic issues, in ways that are less potentially triumphalistic. So how did your engagement of issues change after you had that realization?
Well, you know, I think I just sort of backed away from things for quite a while.
And that's, I mean, that happened a lot in the late 70s and early 80s. There were people who were just stopping to reconsider.
I was just living my life. I went to college. I got married. I wound up in Europe for a while. I came back and just tried to find a way to have a life. Interestingly, what led me into some of the work that I did the longest, which was local history work, was actually through music and dance, because I went to a local living history site in the Hudson Valley, mostly because I knew some musicians were going to be playing there. And while I was there, a woman came up to me and said, "Don't I know you? Haven't you worked here before?" And I said, "No, but, you know, I think I'd like to." And we wound up having an interview on the spot. And and I started working for Sleepy Hollow Restorations and worked there for 10 years or so until I moved here. And I think part of what led, built on that, came from the Clearwater picnics and hearing Pete Seeger. And then working through local history, I became more committed to hearing the stories and sharing the stories of average people as important, not just the big names, but the people who would be anonymous otherwise. And
how did you do that?
We did that by sort of play acting what their lives were, showing people what life was like in the early 1700s, late 1700s, and early 1800s, because there were three sites. It was great fun, really. I got to dress in old-time clothes and learned how to cook in an open hearth over the fire, and learned about 18th century medicine and politics, and realized, okay, in some ways, through one of the things that's really impressed itself on me through the learning local history, and is that things don't change. Politics is politics that way. There's always been conflict. I think people sometimes have a golden view of the past, and it was not that. When you hear the history of average people, average people are average people. They have their struggles. They're not always getting help from the top.
And it's not always the same. It's not always the same vertical conflict. It's lots of different kinds of vertical and horizontal conflicts. And we tend to lose sight of the idea that the body without tension is a corpse. Prior to rigor, and then it's very tense. But really, to be alive is to be dealing with those many, many conflicts, right. The way the muscles oppose each other in our skeleton mm-hmm. and allow us to move, mm-hmm. we have that same kind of
right.
conflict.
Give and take.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And injustice mm-hmm. and things mm-hmm. that maybe ought not be that way.
Right.
You said something was, there was something that was kind of shocking to you that changed or that was a surprise to you. And I'm trying to remember what the reference was.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember what that was also.
You said that there's been a continuity, but there were a few things, and one that was quite, you know, a big change, and I wonder what that was. But maybe we'll come.
Maybe it'll come back to me. I'm not remembering right now.
So let's take a music break. What should we go to next?
I dropped that piece of paper.
There you go.
Okay. Thanks. You know, why don't we play the Gene Ritchie Wondrous Love?
Because sure.
That folk music piece is
appropriate.
It's on lots of levels.
Okay,
yeah.
Here we go.
What wondrous love is this, oh my soul, oh my soul? What wondrous love is this, oh my soul? What wondrous love is this that caused the Lord of bliss to send such perfect peace to soul, to my soul, to send such perfect peace to my soul. To God and to the Lamb I will sing, I will sing. To
listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and that was Gene Ritchie and Wondrous Love. And our guest on this hour is Pamela Goddard. So Pamela, how have you changed mm-hmm. over the years? What have you become more deeply the same? And have you been forced to let go of something you valued deeply mm-hmm. that just wasn't working?
Yeah. I would say I have, in some ways it's an event, it's a life challenge, I guess. The thing I had to let go of was ever being a parent. I kind of grew up knowing that I might have an issue with infertility. My mom had taken an anti-miscarriage drug when I was in utero, and called DES, and that caused some complications.
Sure.
So I sort of knew in my 20s and 30s, okay, it may not be easy for me to get pregnant. And at that time, that was not so big a deal. In fact, it was a little bit comforting. It's like, okay, right. I don't have to worry about that quite so much. Yeah. But when I got into my later 30s and 40s and thought, but now I'd really like to be a parent, that became very painful. And long story short, I was never able to have children. Mm-hmm. And letting go of that dream was probably the most painful thing in my life. And led me directly to a spiritual practice that has been a lifesaver for me. Because when it became abundantly clear that this was never going to happen.
Right.
I really felt like the ground had been taken out from under me.
You're falling into the abyss.
Yeah, and so I said to friends, help, I need something. And fortunately for me, a friend had just come back from retreat with Thich Nhat Hanh and the Plum Village Sangha community. And so gave me some really basic practices and started a meditation group here. And going to that weekly, just learning how to sit with my pain became really, really important. And I was able to attend retreats myself where mm-hmm. Thich Nhat Hanh was talking, and remember one Dharma talk in particular where I know that he had said these things probably in previous Dharma talks that I'd been to, but I was at the right moment to hear it, mm-hmm. which was the teaching on no attainment and nothing to chase after, and saying, you know, just don't run after something. What you need is right in within you. You need to let go of running after. He was really, at that moment, very strong. I can't remember his exact words, but he was very strong in his talk about not running after that thing that you think you need the most.
Right.
And I thought to myself, right, it's time to just let go of this.
Right.
And it was both a cracking open, you know, to letting out the pain, but also then a cracking open to let the light in.
So. Right, right. You used the term that I'd like for you to just, if you mm-hmm. would speak to a little bit. You said, I had to sit with my pain.
Mm-hmm.
What did that mean in practical
It meant terms? Not running away from it. It meant feeling it. It meant sitting there and really feeling what the discomfort was in my chest, what the discomfort was in my throat, in my gut.
Throughout your body.
Throughout my body. Yeah, right. And then watching where my mind went. Excuse me.
Sure.
All the stories I was telling myself about what I thought was necessary, who I thought I was or who I thought I needed to be.
Right.
And then coming back to where things really are. Learning to face that and realize, okay, the big monster under the bed or in the closet is not actually as scary as I might think it is. You know, it's not. Well, one of my teachers calls that fear as, you know, the things that can get churning in your mind as her Stephen King mind. And it's never really as bad as that often. When you stop and take a look at it, turn and take a look at it, it's often not as dramatic as the Stephen King narrative.
Right. What made the reality of the fear less imposing than the fear of the fear? Does that question make sense?
Yeah, I think so. There's a the reality of the fear is it's a fear. But the fear of the fear gets magnified because it just spins into a tornado.
An obsession.
Yeah. And there's a teaching from the Buddha about the second arrow. If you've been wounded by something, say being shot by an arrow,
right,
it hurts. But then if you were to get shot in that exact same space, it's going to hurt even more because the wound is already open and already raw.
Right.
And that second arrow is what we do in our minds by going back to it and poking it and poking it and poking it and just causing ourselves more pain. So learning to stop that cycle, or at least slow it down, to recognize that it's happening.
That it is a cycle.
Yeah.
And that part of the fear that I'm experiencing is the fear that I'm indulging and not just the fact that I'm facing.
Right.
So you had a breathing practice before the meditation skill.
Mm-hmm.
How did that change?
Interestingly, my breathing has changed. Literally has
no,
changed.
I
was an asthmatic child and still have some asthma. But I've noticed over time that I'm able to recognize when an asthmatic episode is coming up and calm that, and I have far fewer of them. Because I think I'm probably using my lungs more effectively. But it's also that fear, because a big component of asthma is fear.
Anxiety,
yeah. And then not being able to use the breath, getting short of breath, hyperventilating in a way, or stopping the breath. And so to notice that and then calm means that I practically never need to use asthma medicine anymore. There are times, when it's mostly allergy related. So it's really transformed my body. I was going to say body and mind, but I'm more and more aware that there's really no separation.
Right.
So yeah.
Or body, heart, and mind. I mean, they are all.
Yep.
For me, when you have something, and you have it authentically, the expression is of one fabric in what you're thinking, what you're emotionally feeling, and how you're physically communicating it, or the sensorily experiencing it. That tends to be a good test of whether it's real.
Right. And, the fear is usually, it's almost always about something that's going to happen, something that you're pretty sure is going to happen. But in fact, we don't know that it's going to happen. And so again, I go back to my teachers who have this wonderful saying, tape it up on the wall, are you sure? Check again. And the reality,
how can
you know that it's true? A couple of days ago, I was thinking to myself, okay, it's never going to rain. It's never going to rain. And I woke up this morning and it was raining. So,
right. And it has been a long drought. We don't see droughts this early, this long in this area, at least in my experience.
And so you start to think you know what the reality is.
Yeah.
But the truth is, my reality, awareness anyway, is that I only know a piece.
Yeah.
And so it helps to let go of thinking I have any control, thinking I need to have any control, and just be here. Yeah.
When did you realize that you could have the sadness of not having children and not have it be the weight of an oppressive disappointment?
That also happened during a weekend meditation retreat. one of the pivotal moments of my life was having this particular retreat, which I think was in 2001. My local Sangha here decided we needed some teaching, some help, some guidance. And at that time, there's a Plum Village Monastery in Vermont. It's since moved to Ellenville, New York. But we wrote to them and said, would it be possible for a couple of the monastics to come and lead a weekend retreat? And so two monks did come, Brother Michael and Brother Sage, and both of whom have since left the order but are still teaching. And I had a total mental, physical, emotional transformation that weekend, and I think it was part because I had the intensity of mindfulness energy around me. I wound up being the one that hosted the two monks with me. And it was the right moment. Mm-hmm. Often these things happen, just come together at the right moment. And I remember Brother Michael led a session of deep relaxation. And during that session, I was deeply in touch with my body and realized that I was simultaneously feeling deep, deep sorrow and deep, deep joy, and that it was possible to hold both mm-hmm. at the same time. Mm-hmm. And having a moment to relax, having many moments, you know, like 5 or 10 minutes, to relax with that awareness mm-hmm. that it's mm-hmm. possible to hold sharp pain, deep sorrow, and joy verging on bliss all at the same time was profoundly transforming. So, mm-hmm. yeah.
This may sound trivial, but I want to ask you, mm-hmm. because I don't think this is something I know and I believe, but mm-hmm. I fail to have the words. Mm-hmm. When you hold them at the same time, mm-hmm. it's not like you are immersed in any one at a moment, which is a lot of life we sense the immersion in one or the other, mm-hmm. but to hold them at the same time, what is that experience like? Can you describe it?
What it's like for me is an opening, and or an expansion, I guess, is probably a better word. And just being aware that there's all this stuff. There was room.
Yeah, let me interrupt. Yeah. An opening of what? An expansion of what? What is that?
Expansion of awareness, I guess. An expansion of understanding, for me, anyway. Mm-hmm. That.
So you meet the universe as an entity meeting the universe, even though you're this contained person, but you meet it with a greater sense of embracing the whole mm-hmm. of it. Am I?
That's part of it. It's really a sense of, I want to say inclusion, but mm-hmm. that's not quite right either, because all of these things imply a separation, and it's sort of it's almost a no self.
It's an sense. Acceptance without having to invite.
It's just an awareness.
Awareness. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
It's
yeah,
just
yeah,
an awareness. Yeah. It's just recognizing.
It was there all along.
That all this is. It's all there all the time. Yeah. It's partly where we put our attention.
Right. And not recoiling with, why was I so clueless, but rather, oh.
That's what it is.
It was there all along. Yeah. That's what it is. And yeah. I am now able to do that. And maybe 30 seconds from now, I may not be able to do that.
I may not have the same full awareness. But at this moment, I'm aware of the interconnectedness, that there's, in some ways, without sorrow, there's no joy. Without, you know,
that's not trivial.
It's like saying, well, without the right side of the coin, there's no left side of the coin, which sounds trivial, but in fact, you know, if you don't have both sides, it disappears.
So. But it allowed you to take the yoke of grief mm-hmm. and despair off, mm-hmm. and or at least to move with freedom, mm-hmm. even though we may still wear those mm-hmm. yokes, but we also have the freedom of the mm-hmm. joy and that.
And to know that I'm not defined just by the despair and the loss, but and that if I'm going towards joy, I'm not avoiding or denying that reality, that it's possible to hold both.
Yeah.
And in fact, necessary.
Let's cut to music.
Okay.
Thank you. This has been a really exciting segment for
me.
What would you like to...
You know what I'd really like to go to is The Better Way to Live Alone. It's a chant that I learned from Brother Michael. I actually learned it at that retreat that I was just talking about, and he sang it during that deep relaxation. I learned it from him and recorded it on my quietness CD.
Cool. Here we go.
Listen, I will teach you what is meant by knowing the better way to live alone. Do not pursue the past. Do not lose yourself in the future. The past no longer is, and the future's not yet come. Oh, look deeply at life just as it is, arising in the very recognize it, invincible, unshakable. Care for it with your heart and with your mind. We must be diligent today to wait till tomorrow is too late, for death comes unexpectedly, and how can we bargain with it? The sage calls the one how to dwell in mindfulness night and day, the one who knows the better way to live alone.
And that was The Better Way to Live Alone, performed by our guest, Pamela Goddard. Wow. No one knows the time of death, and you cannot bargain with it. And I'm going to make a connection to Christianity in the 23rd Psalm. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. It's the fear of death and evil behind that fear that is more damaging than death itself, which is what you were saying before. It's the second arrow. And that Hebrew psalm is a reference, I believe, to that second arrow, though they never made it explicit. When you took out the second arrow from your not being able to have children, you seem to have found a life that you didn't have before. And that's the better way to live alone. If I haven't over-interpreted everything you've said.
The fact that no one knows the time of death and you can't bargain with it means to me, what is that awareness has helped me find joy here and realize it's really important, that this moment is precious, that this relationship I have, you know, in this moment talking to you and the next moment talking to somebody else on this street is precious. Sometimes that it feels like it brings up a sorrow when someone's lost, when we lose someone that's dear to us, or when I hear about the untimely and horrific killing of anyone, really, which has been coming up so much in the news lately. When I really touch it, it's a kind of bittersweet because I'm realizing I'm feeling sorrow because part of me loves that person, even if I've never met them, because I'm aware of how precious they are and how precious this moment is. And it can be really easy in our human minds to spin into or just fall into the sadness without remembering the preciousness.
Right.
And if we can stay to the side of the preciousness, then there's a possibility of more joy.
For me, I've come to think about it in a very slightly different way, that the sorrow of the world is more than I can contain or should attain to, and the joy of the world is more than I can contain or should attain to, but I have to have what I can and not allow myself to be wiped out or overwhelmed by either, but to take it to where I can, because if I try to take too much sorrow, then I become enveloped in sadness and depression. And if I try to take in more joy than I can and watch it kind of wash over me, then I become almost manic and lost in a slightly different sort of way. But these are ways of managing who we are in a world beyond our comprehension and control.
Yeah, it's important to be aware of one's capacity, and sometimes we're more aware of that expanded self. And sometimes, because of whatever, we're having a bad day.
We can't.
And so to not do ourselves the damage of trying to take on more than we can.
And to tell others around us that I honor where you are, but I can't be there right now. And actually that is being there.
Right.
Which is the irony of that statement.
In my more expansive moments, I'm aware that I'm more than just this body and this particular lifespan. But as I credit my teachers and my family because they really are me, and I will continue on in others. And so if I don't see the sorrow and the joy just as mine, but I get some of the me out of it, then there's more capacity.
It flows.
Yeah. Yep.
It flows.
Exactly.
Now, the way I prefer to close this show is with the question, what do you do on a daily, weekly, monthly, annual basis to restore yourself emotionally, physically, intellectually, which I think when you work on all of those levels is the spiritual life. What do you do, and how do you know you need to do it?
I think I'll start with the how do I know that I need to do it? Which is usually that I'm feeling constricted and that my capacity is not there. That I'm feeling wrung out. I'm feeling
when do you notice?
I'm not sure I can say on the air.
Yes, you can say. There are very few words. There's only one that was a major.
that I'm feeling really grumpy.
Yeah, we'll take it from there. Yeah.
That I'm not behaving well with the people that I care about. And then I think, okay, I either need to take a walk.
Right.
I need to listen to some music, or I need to play some music. I need to, getting out in nature, if it's possible to do that, is really helpful. Getting for a breath of fresh air. Music is very, very healing for me and very important. So I do that a lot.
I want to go back to that.
Yeah.
When you notice it, do you notice it autonomously in yourself, or do you notice it because you see the impact you're having on the world around you?
Both.
Or is it some of both?
Yeah, it's both. Yeah. I probably notice it in myself first and then realize, okay, it's even more than I think.
Because you
because
see,
I see that I'm, you know, it's, I think it's more that I hear how I'm reacting to somebody and right. think that's not the way I want to deal with this.
Yeah.
I'm, you know,
or I
and,
see for me, I see
somebody
the shock
else may
in
not
their face.
Seeing it, you know, as bad as I feel it. But, and sometimes I then do say, you know, I'm sorry, I can't deal with this right now. Give me 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Let me eat something. Let me get out. Because sometimes it's just that I need something to eat or drink. But,
right.
Yeah.
So you nourish the body in that way.
Yeah.
You listen to music. You take a walk. You
mm-hmm.
breathe.
Mm-hmm.
And that's those are the immediate responses.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do on a more regular basis mm-hmm. or for a deeper,
right.
I would say, almost restart or cleanse
yeah.
or whatever you want to call it?
Well, I do have... I have a kind of meditation practice, although, I mean, I meditate regularly, and there's a weekly session that I go to. I'm not one of those who's real good about getting her butt on the cushion.
Yeah. I raised my hand because
I've gotten much better about walking meditation of a sort, even mm-hmm. if it's just walking across the room.
Sure.
Or daily life activities done in mindfulness,
right.
washing the dishes, chopping vegetables, playing an instrument. I'm learning to play the harp, which is wonderful,
uh-huh.
and that's become a real practice for me.
And what I hear in the practice is that you immerse yourself in the activity
right.
without becoming self-conscious
mm-hmm.
in that immersion.
Yeah, well, I would say in some ways I become more self-conscious.
More
attuned.
Because
more attuned
yeah, yeah.
to
yeah.
where I am in the moment, but less involved in the mental story.
Not narrating is what I mean.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, not narrating
yeah.
what you're doing,
yeah.
but just simply doing it.
Right, yeah. So yeah. conscious on a deeper level.
Right, right. Immediate.
Yeah.
Immediate.
Yeah.
And there's kind of a... One line I've heard about spiritual disciplines is sometimes we need to learn to do things so that we don't have to do them.
Mm-hmm.
And they come into our lives
mm-hmm.
because for one summer, I practiced 2 hours of silent meditation a day. And I did that for nearly 3 months daily. And it left such an impact on my body that I can straighten my spine and breathe deeply. And I can almost go back to that
mm-hmm,
moment.
Mm-hmm.
Your
body, your cells learn that.
Right.
And one of the teachings that I take to heart a lot mm-hmm. from Thich Nhat Hanh, from my teachers in that tradition, is practice now so that you don't wait for the crisis to practice
right.
because
you can't do it then. Right.
Practice now so that you have that strength then. And that's why we call it practice. It's like if you want to know how to swing a tennis racket and hit a ball, you need to practice.
Yeah. Right. Right.
And so that, you know, coming back to each daily moment, I'm realizing, for me, at least right now, I mean, practice on the cushion, that formal practice is really helpful and important.
Mm-hmm.
But more important is the daily moment-to-moment, being aware, okay, I'm sitting in a chair. What does it feel like to sit in a chair?
Yeah.
I'm washing dishes. What does it feel like to wash dishes? I'm so grateful I have water to wash dishes.
Right. And the hands
and the eyes.
And
there's so many practices in the Plum Village tradition to keep us in that daily moment-to-moment practice. And the wonderful thing about it is you can be practicing and nobody knows you're practicing because
yeah.
you're
yeah.
just walking through life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Pamela, it's been a delight to get to know you.
Thank you. Thank you for this opportunity.
You are most welcome. This is exactly how I hope that we get to know each other mm-hmm. in ways that are deep and also respectful.
Mm-hmm.
You wanted to close with Phil Oakes When I'm Gone. Do you want to say anything about that before we play?
Only that sort of going back to some of the political awareness part of our discussion early on, it came to my attention that this year is the 40th anniversary of Phil Oakes' death. And I heard a group of people singing this song at a folk festival only a few weeks ago and realized it's still very powerful. In some ways a guiding means for my life. I thought it would be a lovely thing to share and for me to hear again. So.
Well, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
There's no place in this world where I'll belong when I'm gone. And I won't know the right from the wrong when I'm gone. And you won't find me singing on this song when I'm gone. So I guess I'll have to do it while I'm here. And I won't feel the flowing of the time when I'm gone. All the pleasures of love will not be mine when I'm gone. My pen won't pour a lyric line when I'm gone. So I guess I'll have to do it while I'm here. And I won't breathe the bracing air when I'm gone. And I can't even worry about my cares when I'm gone. Won't be asked to do my share when I'm gone. So I guess I'll have to do it while I'm here. And I won't be running from the rain when I'm gone. And I can't even suffer from the pain when I'm gone. Can't say who's to praise and who's to blame when I'm gone. So I guess I'll have to do it while I'm here. Won't see the golden of the sun when I'm gone. And the evenings and the mornings will be one when I'm gone. Can't be singing louder than the guns while I'm gone. So I guess I'll have to do it while I'm here. All my days won't be dances of delight when I'm gone. And the sands will be shifting from my sight when I'm gone. Can't add my name into the fight while I'm gone. So I guess I'll have to do it while I'm here. And I won't be laughing at the lies when I'm gone. And I can't question how or when or why when I'm gone. Can't live proud enough to die when I'm gone. So I guess I'll have to do it while I'm here. There's no place in this world where I'll belong when I'm gone. And I won't know the right from the wrong when I'm gone. And you won't find me singing on this song when I'm gone. So I guess I'll have to do it. I guess I'll have to do it. Guess I'll have to do it while I'm here.